generally, it's usually something like the promise of a job. And then when you get there to do the job, it's abuse, physical, mental, sexual abuse, and also maybe you can't walk away. So you can't leave. Your documents are taken or something like that. But it's not...
This is the Hardcore Humanities Podcast, plus our researcher recommendations. In each episode, I'll be chatting to a researcher from one of the UK's best universities. We'll discuss their work in any topic within the humanities, and at the end of each episode, our researcher will give us some recommendations for further reading, links to which can be found on the Hardcore Humanities website and social media. I'm Jamie, and you are welcome to the podcast. Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to this episode of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. On today's episode, I am joined by Lucy Mahaffey. Now, Lucy is a sociologist from Cambridge University. She is also a graduate of the University of Oklahoma with a double major in international area studies and interdisciplinary perspectives of slavery and exploitation. Now, Lucy is currently at Cambridge University studying for her Masters of Philosophy in Sociology in Marginality and Exclusion. Now, her focus is on modern slavery, specifically in the US. So, Lucy, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin with, why don't you tell us why you decided to commit your studies and your time and your energy to this study of modern slavery?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually get asked that sometimes because people say, like, you know, why do you study it so serious? When I was actually about 12 years old, I kind of was watching a film, actually. And in the bonus features of the film, they talked about how modern slavery, like slavery, still existed. And it really surprised me. So I started doing more and more research. And then I learned that actually it wasn't just modern slavery in some sort of other place. It was also in the United States, which is where I'm from. And that really shocked me because we just learned about the Emancipation Proclamation in history, actually. And so, you know, here I am a decade later, still kind of focused on it. So the more I learned, and especially when I started meeting survivors, especially during my high school experience, I really just couldn't kind of stop focusing on it. So I have lots of other interests as well, but I really think kind of meeting people that have survived it gives you a different perspective.
Right. And for the sake of clarity for our conversation, is there a difference between human trafficking and modern slavery, or are they just two different names for the same thing?
It's a fantastic question. Lots of people get these. So in the United States, they are legally the same. The UK tends to use the term modern slavery, and the US tends to use the term human trafficking. And a lot of times when people think of trafficking, they think of movement, but you don't actually have to move. You could be trafficked. I think of exploited. You could be exploited in your own home.
Right. And before we get into the sort of nitty-gritty of your research and your work, can you just take us through how it actually works? Like, what are the techniques and strategies of human traffickers? Who's involved? Where does it happen? How does it happen?
Okay, that's a big question. So right now, there are lots of big kind of ranges for numbers, but I think that the International Office on Migration and International Labor Organization say there's about 40 million people, 40.3 million people that are victims of trafficking globally. And so there are lots of different types, and that depends on the country, that depends on the sector, that could depend on the kind of, you know, group of people as well. So I focus on the United States. So there's about 25 types of trafficking in the United States. I think there's about 17 recognized in the UK. And a lot of people think of the movie Taken, but that's not a representative of trafficking at all. So it's not someone getting kidnapped. It's not Liam Neeson breaking down doors generally. It's usually something like the promise of a job. And then when you get there to do the job, it's abuse, physical, mental, sexual abuse, and Also, maybe you can't walk away, so you can't leave. Your documents are taken or something like that. But it's not, it's almost never physical chains.
Right.
So that's a short answer to like a very big question.
Yeah, sorry, I'm going to push you a little bit more on it. Can you just get specific about some of those different types? Because as you say, my sort of image of this is, I wouldn't say exactly like taken, but it's someone is kidnapped, basically. And that's about as far as my understanding, and I imagine quite a lot of people's understanding of it, would go. So can you just get specific with regards to these different types of modern slavery and trafficking?
Sure. Okay, so it's almost never... it's almost never kidnapping. It's usually either the promise of a good job, or it's usually someone that the person knows, whether it's like a distant friend or a relative. So there are two big types. There's labor trafficking and there's sex trafficking. And then there are lots of different types within those. So for labor, it could be domestic work, like a maid, or it could be like logging in the forest, or it could be farm workers. Those are just a few types. But I mean, there could also be people at like nail salons. That's been a big thing in the news in the US and the UK lately, actually. But for sex trafficking, that could be a wide range of stuff. So it could be, you know, it could be actually online stuff, or it could be actually walking around streets, so residential, or it could be like massage parlors. And again, that's actually a big, lots of articles are about that in the US right now. So those are some more specifics.
And the criminals that are behind this, they, say we're in the United States, they tend to be citizens of the United States, right?
Yeah, and so that's an interesting, there's not enough demographic data on this. And when you get into data, it gets to be really tricky. But yes, a lot of the victims and a lot of the perpetrators are citizens of the United States. A lot of people have a misconception that it would be like non-citizens, but that's not true. There certainly are people that aren't citizens that are being exploited and that are exploiting, but that doesn't, like in Oklahoma, my own state, the majority of perpetrators are Oklahomans. They're citizens.
Right. I think, again, possibly because of Taken, it's that kind of image of the foreigner coming in and kidnapping someone and taking them back to their home country or whatever. So that's quite surprising to me to hear. And what do governments or the police or law enforcement, how do they respond to this?
Yeah, so I mean, again, it's huge. So it depends what country or even kind of what area or region you're talking about. But like for my own state, so it's about 3/4 the size of the UK for land. But instead of 69 million, we have barely 4 million people. So it's like much more spread out. So that's kind of tricky for law enforcement. But we have three main law enforcement groups that focus on this type of case, like human trafficking, in my state. So there's three groups that have to kind of monitor 4 million people. That's a lot.
Right. You half answered my next question there. I was going to ask, how does the response differ from country to country or state to state? Or is there some kind of united approach towards tackling modern slavery at all?
Yeah, so I mean, there definitely is, but there's so many differences. So there are lots of different international nonprofits or international groups, and they could be from many, many different countries. And so there, you'll get international collaboration, you'll also get nationwide collaboration, or even just like regional kind of statewide or countywide collaboration. But there's a lot of different layers.
But specifically, what are the strategies of law enforcement? What kind of things do they do or put in place to try and tackle this?
Yeah, so I do think, just to answer your question and also push back slightly, a lot of people think law enforcement's the solution or law enforcement has to be the key response. But I think that's a misconception, because this comes out of a lot of different vulnerabilities within a society. And so you can't only respond with law enforcement. You also have to respond with health services and with housing and with education and all sorts of other things. But law enforcement specifically, they will try to arrest perpetrators. And there's been a big movement in the last decade to really make sure the people they're arresting are not also victims, because sometimes victims will be turned into perpetrators and to like as this kind of survival technique. And so, especially in my own state, there's actually a law now saying like if someone was victimized, like they have to get help. They can't be arrested, even if they ended up victimizing someone else. So,
right.
I don't know if that makes sense. There's a lot of layers.
Yeah, it sounds like an extremely complicated thing, and way more complicated than I imagine lots of other people could have imagined. So when it comes to your studies and your work, I think you were alluding to this a little bit in your previous answer there. Why did you decide to focus on the response to modern slavery and human trafficking as opposed to its causes?
It's a good question. So I want to get at the causes, but short answer is I thought that it would be easier and maybe a better stepping stone to focus on the response first to see, because through lots of conversations, and I've been focusing on this for kind of over a decade, is a lot of people didn't know who is doing what, where, and how. So I really just wanted to kind of just basically find that out, just even find out who to talk to ask them about what the problem was. So it's almost kind of like working backwards.
Right. And what have you found out about the responses?
Yeah. So I reached out to over 103 groups across my state, and I got some good response. So I ended up working with about 40 different groups, and I got surveys, 32 surveys and 10 interviews to kind of map out what was happening. So there are two task forces in the state, which is exciting. And there are three law enforcement groups and three shelters. We call them victim service providers, but they are shelters as well. And they're certified specifically for adult sex trafficking, which is very unique because a lot of places just kind of lump them in with domestic violence or other kind of shelters. So we have very unique certification.
And what is it that's unique about them?
So they have very specific training to deal with only human trafficking survivors, because there's a very specific trauma of having, for instance, you know, maybe 30 abusers every day versus one over 10 or 20 years. Just for instance.
Right. Oh man. Yeah. You, as you said at the start, this is an extremely heavy thing to be studying.
Yeah. And I should warn, we can go intense, or we can also go like more bird's eye view. I realize I stare at this all the time. So I'm used to some of the numbers, I guess. So.
Yeah. Well, I guess my response there was the shock that there might be 30 people abusing one person. And then you said, as opposed to sort of one abuser over a long amount of time. And I'm just thinking, this is just like two terrible evils, you know? But we will plow on. In your studies, you look at race and gender. Why was it important to study those two things? What is the relevance there?
Yeah. So one of the things I found I got a master's last year from the University of Nottingham. And in my dissertation last year, I found that actually Black Oklahomans and Native American Oklahomans were disproportionately impacted by trafficking in our state. And there's evidence to back that up on a national level as well. But I'm the first person that's actually kind of crunched the numbers from four data sets in our state and found that out. And so kind of this year, I really wanted to dive into, okay, why? Like, and there's so many hypotheses and things I could talk about, but I just really wanted to get into that because that's a big deal. and no one had really kind of been talking about that from my discussions last year.
And have you got close to any answers as to why that is?
Not yet. I'm still kind of in the throes of research. So
right.
I'll just go back.
Right. And with regards to finding out that Black Oklahomans are disproportionately affected by this, how does that happen? And I guess that's a slightly different question to why, which I know you said you haven't been able to answer yet, but how does someone fall into this, and how does a group find itself being mostly affected by this?
Yeah, and so it's not just Black Oklahomans, it's also Native Americans. So we have 38 tribes in our state because it was supposed to be Indian territory. And so it's a very unique kind of demographic difference than like the UK. and so for both of those populations, I think I don't have a clear answer, but I will say kind of just over the past couple hundred years, certain groups, specifically African Americans and Native Americans, have been disenfranchised, whether that's through education or housing or health services. There's a lot of layers. And so just generationally, you'll have pockets of society that are more vulnerable and with fewer resources. And so I think that that leads to one of the key words is, instead of the concept of chains, is people talk about vulnerability. So with modern slavery, the word you'll hear a lot is vulnerability. And so whether that's like a lack of access to education or a lack of job security, you'll just see that I think Black Oklahomans and Native American Oklahomans have more of those vulnerabilities.
Right. But I assume you would say that when it comes to the response of the response to human trafficking, at least on an individual to individual basis, your response is going to be the same, isn't it? No matter what racial group a person is from or what gender they are, you are obviously going to respond in with heartbreak and wish them the fastest recovery possible. So with that in mind, why is it important to you to look at the differences in the groups?
Yeah, so like I said, working my way backwards, so now that I've discovered how people are kind of responding to this, I want to get more at the causes. And if we can figure out what's causing these groups to fall into this more and more, then we can hopefully prevent it from even happening. So my ultimate goal is to just like work myself out of a job. It's to like prevent anything bad happening to anybody. But in order to do that, instead, because a lot of groups are kind of being reactive, so you have to have services after bad stuff happens. You have to help people. But my ultimate goal would be to actually prevent any of that from needing to happen, if that makes sense.
Right, sure. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was, I was reading some of your articles and some of your work, and you also look into, or at least the word colonialism comes up quite a lot. Now, when people hear the word colonialism, I imagine a lot of them think of this outdated form of governance from the 17th and 18th centuries, mostly European countries getting involved, making settlements in overseas territories. Why is this relevant to modern slavery? And I guess modern being the key word there. How is colonialism relevant to modern slavery?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons I'm kind of looking into this concept of colonialism, so colonialism is settlers coming into this land and kind of taking political control over it, as well as like economic kind of control. And so, I mean, we can all say that happened in America, you know, in the 17, 1800s. But it's still relevant today because it set up the structures that we're living in. And so if you take Oklahoma, for example, by shoving almost all of the Native Americans to one place in Oklahoma, they've been exposed to huge vulnerabilities because structurally, the state was not set up to help them. It was set up to kind of confine them and then exclude them. So all that to say, I'm looking at colonialism today because it's this big kind of superstructure for why exploitation is happening. And in order to respond to the exploitation or to understand the causes, you have to understand the kind of bigger picture of the exploitation.
Right. And when you say colonialism set up the structures of Oklahoma, I'm not entirely sure the history of Oklahoma and when it joined the Union. But when you talk about these structures, what are you referring to there?
Yeah, so Oklahoma joined the Union in 1907. I think we were the second to last. We were in the last like two or three states that joined, because it was up until that point Indian territory. I guess some of the examples I keep coming back to are education, health services, transportation, housing. also access to like land and access to like kind of long-term economic gains. So all of those were kind of withheld in many ways from Native Americans for generations.
Okay, and so what is the link between that? Because there are economically deprived areas, you know, all over America and, of course, the UK and various other places around the world. But what is the link between the deprived resources in terms of economically and also access to things like healthcare and education? What is the link between that and modern slavery?
Yeah, so you're right. There are tons of vulnerable and economically deprived places throughout the country. And so, like, Oklahoma is not unique in that sense, right? And pockets of Oklahoma certainly aren't unique in that sense. I think the kind of unique story is that it was specifically set out to be Indian territory. And so the larger kind of concept of vulnerability exists. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is just specifically using Oklahoma as like a case study within kind of this greater American context.
Right. I think a lot of people would respond by agreeing, you know, that the past of, or the history of Oklahoma and how it joined the Union and the fact that it was Native American territory prior to that, I think people would agree that that may have some impact in the modern day, but it's the link to modern slavery that I'm wondering what that link is.
Yeah, and I'm still trying to figure some of that out, but as an example, so even today, and I think that this context might help, is right now Oklahoma is a checkerboard of jurisdictions. So if a crime happened, there are 38 tribes and tribal governments. They have their own law enforcement, and they have their own governments, and they have their own jurisdictions. And so if a crime like human trafficking happened in that land, in like their jurisdiction, that would be separate from non-tribal jurisdictions. So basically, you have to determine, is the victim Native or not Native American? Is the perpetrator Native American or not? And is the crime happening on Native land or not? And so what I'm ultimately getting to is there's a massive gap in like Native American women are basically, they're going missing at huge numbers. They're being murdered at huge numbers. And almost all of them are being sexually assaulted. And the crimes aren't getting prosecuted because there's this kind of limbo of jurisdictions.
Before we get on to your recommendations, what do you hope your research achieves in the longer term and in the bigger picture?
Yeah, so I mean, we've talked about a lot of layers of things. Things are kind of messy. And so I really hope that if it doesn't have all the answers, I really hope that it can maybe start some conversations about the exploitation that's going on and maybe kind of help, and not, it doesn't even have to be a roadmap, but just kind of get at the next best step for our state.
Okay, great. Let's move on to the researcher recommendations. Can you give us your first recommendation for further reading, please?
Yeah, of course. I'd highly recommend Collaborating Against Human Trafficking by Kirsten Foote, if you want to focus more on kind of the response to things. She goes across multiple states and did a multiple-year kind of deep dive on how they were responding to human trafficking and kind of looks at the mistakes as well as the good stuff that she saw over and over again.
Great. And you have another recommendation?
Yes. If you kind of want to take a step back and look at modern day slavery broadly, you can look at the modern day slave narratives by Laura Murphy. That is really moving, and it is firsthand accounts of survivors told in their own words. So it's very powerful.
Wow. And do you have any more?
The last one, if you want something like really kind of broad, is called Blood and Earth by Kevin Bales. And that looks at modern slavery and the exploitation of people. But it also looks at how when people are exploited, usually the climate and land are exploited as well. So he looks into kind of a lot of different industries where there's kind of a nexus between the two.
Okay, great. So, Lucy, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and I wish you all the best with the future of your research.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you have enjoyed it, please do us a massive favor and tell all of your friends about the Hardcore Humanities podcast. You could also give us a good rating or review and follow us on social media. And don't forget to check out our researcher recommendations. Until next time, ciao for now.